This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Hey, everyone. It's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century. And that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
I want to be your endgame.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast. You're the only place to start is with the inadequacy of men, of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica. Big reputation, ooh, you and me, we got big reputations, and you heard about me, ooh, I got some big enemies.
Big reputation, ooh, you and me would be a big conversation, and I heard about you, ooh, you like the bad ones too. You're so dope, don't overdose, I'm so stoked.
It's listener mailbag episode. Guys really came through. Loads and loads and loads. Dozens and dozens of questions. We're going to get to as many of them as we can. The gang is here. Well, part of the gang is here. Joe Coscarelli, a.k.a. Miss Americana, is here.
Yes, I'm here off the book.
Yes, that's true.
Can we use this to make the announcement?
Sure. So Joe's going to go on book leave for
about
TK
months.
Months, and he's doing this on the arm, as they say.
Yes.
I may slide him a 20 just for the day rate or something afterwards, maybe buy him a donut or something.
At this moment, I am an employee of the New York Times, but not really an employee of the New York Times. So
that
I might get wild.
That
on
means
this
he's
podcast.
Free. He's free to tell you what he really thinks. Opinions are back.
Yes. I also want to say on the record, while I'm looking in your eyes, I will come back for certain podcasts if necessary. Please don't be afraid to ask.
Do I strike you as a person who's afraid to ask?
No. And I know we've missed maybe the window for these, but if they come back around, I'm talking specifically Pine Grove and Halsey.
Yes.
We can do one Pine Grove Halsey podcast.
Well, we have a good Pine Grove question here. So that's actually a good start. And also maybe for potential podcast events, TBD. Just throwing that out there. Actually, wait. Before we get back to the other thing, we have forgotten to talk about the Heartbreak Prince.
I was worried.
Karen Gans is here.
I assumed.
Karen has had a labor-filled 10 to 12 days and is going to be taking some time off from the New York Times, from John Caramonica. From everybody's taking time off. I will be the last person. I will be responsible for all pop music coverage.
I hope you're running the section.
Yeah. I'm going to be doing that for at least the next few days. Let's go big on mailbag. A lot of questions. Let's just go two parts. Let's just do it. We're going to sit. We're here. We're sitting at the table. Let's just go long. We're going to go long. We're going to go dumb. Joe, you and I were having a conversation. We were talking about people who write into podcasts and people who are big podcast fans and trying to figure out a way for them to organize. Right? Mm-hmm.
This is the call to arms?
It's sort of. So, okay. So here's the thing. I called Karen one day. Do you know about this conversation?
Yes. A little bit.
So I called Karen one day. And anyone who has an office job will find this humorous. And I said, Karen, how does Slack work?
And I was so happy because it was something I could actually answer.
But you also thought maybe I would get on Slack.
Possible.
Yeah, no. That no.
This is also Times critic privilege.
It is Times
critic. To not know.
There are a few privileges that I'm interested in preserving. I believe in the destruction of privilege, broadly speaking, but I would like to preserve the privilege to not be on Slack. So anyway, the reason I asked is because I have a friend who runs a different podcast, and he said he had a very active Slack for all the listeners. And I was like, damn, we got to get a Slack going for Popcast. And then I talked to Karen, and Karen was basically like, nah, you can't do that because the New York Times Slack is private and et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not smart enough about technology to know what else to do. And then there was that article about the Facebook groups thing.
Yeah, in the New York Times.
I've read the New York Times.
You're familiar with it?
I've read the New York Times. And I thought, is that a thing that, like, somehow should exist?
Mm-hmm. Which is a Facebook group for listeners of the Popcast.
Right. It's not like an official Popcast thing because I don't think we can maintain it, strictly speaking, but we can hang out and say hi.
Yeah, an unauthorized.
Right.
We're saying if you want to start a Facebook group to talk about
Popcast
and the various personalities that come through.
If you are Ganscore and you would like to find other people who are Ganscore, that seems like a place it could happen.
Yeah.
We can't – look, it's like the thing with the swipe at the subway. Yeah. It's like you can't ask for it. But, like, if it happens, it's all good, and theoretically it's legal. So
I will take this opportunity to plug our Twitter, which is also a great place for people to congregate.
That's – Karen is in charge of the Twitter. So just know
that
if you're ever rude to the Twitter, you're being rude to Karen.
Directly to me, at NY Times Music.
Follow and subscribe. So anyway, if there were a Facebook group for Popcast
–
I'd be in it.
Not shut it down.
Here's the thing.
So you're saying you're both on Facebook.
We are, but we're not friends.
Okay. I can't believe we're already at the really hostile part of the mailbag episode.
You haven't even answered any questions.
I know, because I have a question.
Why hasn't Joe followed
you
on Facebook?
Why hasn't Joe accepted my friend request from 9 years ago? That's a question.
I just like seeing your face in my little.
I will cut you. I will literally cut you. This will be the final Popcast episode. They will be walking me out of here in chains.
I just think it's better. And one day, you know, I'm going to accept the request, and it's going to be at the very right moment.
Yeah, the day of my death. You know, like when someone in Juice WRLD dies, he like gains 500,000 followers. Yeah. That will be the day that Joe accepts my Facebook friend request. So anyway, thanks for your support, Joe.
Could be in the same group.
But here's the thing about the Facebook thing, which is I had another friend who I was talking to about cars. I like cars. I had drive an old Mercedes. He drives old BMWs. And I was like, where do you find out? Like, where do you find those people? And he was like, on Facebook. And I was like, that seems terrible. And he was like, no. I unfriended like all my friends and family members and only friended people who are into cars, and Facebook rocks now. So maybe we'll do something like that with regards to Popcast.
Yeah, I lurk in the Who Weekly Facebook group. I know there's many Who Weekly Facebook groups, mm-hmm. but like the main one, mm-hmm. I lurk in it, and it's a wonderful community. And I see people that I knew like from high school. I see people that I knew from college. You know, just like random
Amazing.
People from my life all come together in the Who Weekly Facebook group. And I think that's a beautiful thing.
I think then we'll just put it out there. And if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't happen, no harm, no foul. But with the aggregated energy that I got in the inbox the past 4 days, I'm thinking somebody maybe can pull it together. So let us know if you do it. Here's a question. We open with Taylor Swift's reputation. It's a big reputation. And here's a question from Eamon O'Neill. Eamon wants to know, and this is – I'm starting with this question because this is the only question – there are a lot of really, really good questions. This is the only question that made me like almost snarf. It's very concise. After watching Miss Americana, do you think that Taylor Swift thinks Reputation is a good record?
I have an answer.
No, I have an answer too. But like, go in. I'm curious.
I think she thinks it's an underwhelming record, and she's wrong.
Yes, that's the correct answer. That's absolutely the
right world
answer.
Told her that it wasn't her best
and
album. And she believed it.
Okay, so here's the thing.
But I'm not saying it's her best album. But yeah. I just mean like the world told her it was a bad Taylor Swift album.
And she believed it. And here's the other part of that. We learned a bunch of things in Miss Americana. And there are so many – I understand there's a lot of Miss Americana questions. We're not going to get to all of them because it's – well, first of all, a lot of them came before Joe and I got in the Google Doc. So a lot of that stuff's been answered. But one thing that we saw in Miss Americana that I sort of maybe intuitively always knew was a thing that happened but had never witnessed was – Tree, who is Taylor's publicist, reading things to Taylor. Shout out to Tree. Reading things.
She reads a Perez Hilton thing. Yeah.
As if anybody gives a nonsense about, like, who cares about Perez Hilton? But I'm imagining Tree cautiously reading the best parts of bad reviews of Reputation to Taylor. So I'm imagining that happening and Taylor basically being Taylor taking in the negative undertones, even though Tree's trying to, like, frame it positively. Mm-hmm. And that results in what I think you said, Joe, which is that, no, Taylor thinks Reputation is not good.
Or like a slight misfire.
Yes. But we are here to remind everybody Taylor is wrong.
And that was something that I really took away from watching Miss Americana was there are so many segments from the Reputation tour and little bits of the recording of Reputation, some with Max Martin, some with Jack Antonoff. She comes out with a hood, you know, it's like pouring rain in MetLife Stadium, like all that stuff. And I'm like, damn, all of these songs bang. Like all the Reputation songs, when you hear them now outside of the stress of the Kanye context and all of that, and Look What You Made Me Do, which is a bad first single, which we've talked about, it's a good album.
Yeah, totally agree. So I think maybe the most disheartening thing is that the person who needs to believe that doesn't believe that.
Taylor, come on, podcast.
I mean, please.
Someday.
Someday. We'll hold the chair. We'll hold the memorial chair whenever she's ready. Okay, here's another question. I don't think this is a Taylor subtweet question, but it could be in a couple of years. This is from Eugene Ivanov. The last decade was marked by many former pop stars fading to relative obscurity. The latest records by Christina Aguilera, Fergie, Britney Spears, among others, had the record labels touting their comebacks, which eventually never happened. Even Madonna, Karen.
Everyone's gaze shifts to Gans.
Yes.
The next 7 minutes will be devoted to Karen. Even Madonna, who bounced back multiple times in the 90s and 2000s, had her last hit in 2009. I don't know if I'm not fact-checking that. That's just what this says. Since then, she's released 3 albums, but her songs have failed to have any success with both the general public and, John Perella's strange affinity for Unapologetic Bitch aside, the critics.
It's a great song.
Pedro, can we have 20 seconds of Unapologetic Bitch, please?
Yes. Now I know why I came. This is an amazing song.
It might sound like I'm an unapologetic bitch, but sometimes you know I gotta call it like it is. It might sound like I'm an unapologetic bitch, but sometimes you know I gotta call it like it is. You know you never really know how much you love me till you lost me, did you? You know you never really know how much your selfish bullshit cost me.
Here's the question. Is the quote-unquote comeback record a thing of the past, now that major labels and radio have less control over what music is popular? Should most artists who have fallen out of the charts make peace with being on a never-ending greatest hits tour?
Comeback record's not dead.
Tell us,
who has it in them?
I would say that the fandoms will declare it a comeback record if the radio doesn't.
Okay, so you think that there are multiple conceptions or frameworks of what can constitute a successful comeback
record.
But
you're talking about a return to form record, not a comeback record. That, to me, you need the outside approval, the commercial approval for it to count as a comeback.
Do you? Because what if the commercial approval is purely from within the fan base?
That is what I'm
like,
saying.
Like, what if it's like...
Like every Eminem album selling 500,000 copies first week.
Yeah.
But none of them are a comeback.
Right.
Is that true, though?
Was Recovery a comeback? There was
I can't
one
tell
was
the
comeback.
Difference between any of them. I can't. Don't. If, God forbid, I ever go on Jeopardy and there's like a music category and there's an Eminem question,
you're gonna get it wrong.
I'm going to get it wrong. I'm like the pop music critic in the New York Times, and I'm going to get it wrong.
But I'll tell you who I'm thinking of when I said my answer. I think you know who I'm talking about. Lady Gaga.
Say more.
Yes.
Keep going.
Or as the kids say these days, say less.
I think we can agree, at least in this company, that Joanne is not a good record.
Only in this company can we agree that?
There are Joanne stands. Bethany from Best Coast, I learned during my interview, Joanne stan. We had to agree to disagree. Anyway, that album.
How did you get through the rest of the interview?
I don't know how I didn't just get up and leave. Art Pop, bad album.
Yes.
Fun, weird, bad.
Bad.
If you listen to the lead song from a couple of weeks ago, I believe it's called Stupid Love.
I have not listened to it. I don't believe in listening to leaks. That's not true.
That's so like 2004.
I just don't care about Lady Gaga.
Well, it's a fantastic song. It is a return to form. But if she makes a whole record that's this good, even if it didn't sell, because things just don't necessarily sell the way they did, even if it didn't sell, if it was this good, that's a comeback record.
But I think the question is asking, and I might be misreading the question, but I think the question is saying, even if she makes a record, say that song is an A, and even if she makes a record that's thematically consistent, full of A's.
But it doesn't hit.
It doesn't hit.
Yeah, but the yardsticks have moved.
Roddy Ricch is still number one.
Yeah.
Is that a comeback record? Does that count? To say the thing that's really on my mind, Justin Bieber. I'm not saying the record's going to hit or it's not going to hit, but I'm saying there's a world where if there isn't a successful second single after Yummy,
Is Yummy a successful single?
Yo, are we already? Okay. Wow. Okay. This is Karen. You know, I went to a wrestling match the other day. Yeah. Let's go. Yummy is a solid B.
Yummy did the old free dive from the top of the charts.
Because the world has agreed.
Yummy is a solid. Yummy is a solid B, and I'll stand
by
it.
But it's not a hit.
No, it's not a hit. But it's also a little too low-key to be a hit.
Which is why it was a weird choice
for
a first single.
It's a strange choice. I mean, we haven't heard the rest of the record, so
we don't know. But Bieber doesn't need a comeback album because Purpose was huge and had a bunch of great singles. And what would he be coming back from? Just taking some time off to marry Hailey Baldwin?
No, he'd be coming back from having like a complicated emotional inner life and deep turmoil and having a tour where he trapped himself in a Lucite box and traveled around the world.
But that's what happened last time he was coming back from same depression.
Every Justin Bieber tour and album has been a comeback album of some kind. But I do think fundamentally someone like him could have a comeback. It could be framed as such and it could achieve on those terms.
I don't see it. You know who I think has perfected this though is Pink, who has basically stopped.
I didn't expect that either.
I didn't expect either where I was going with this. She basically stopped trying to play the game where you think of something like Man of the Woods, where Timberlake took some time off and then he was like, I'm coming back and I'm coming right back into the conversation, the main conversation. And Pink is just
he
did not, right. So Pink is just like, I'm going to put out an album every year, every 18 months, whatever. And people are going to come to my greatest hits tour and I'll have an adult AC hit from this album because I can write a ballad like nobody's business. But she's not trying to play in the sandbox with the kids.
But also, like, to me, and maybe I'm misreading the idea of the comeback record, but if you are always kind of vibrating at like a B-plus frequency, I don't think you can come back to – I think it's a question of can Janet Jackson, you know, like someone who's like an A-plus. I feel like the idea
the
of a comeback
no. I agree that the
can
comeback
only
record
apply
–
for people like that,
right.
Or the concept.
But you're talking about older people who had success earlier coming back in that sense. For me, Gaga isn't like old. So the comeback
How old is
just
Lady Gaga?
Like old 30, by pop star standards. Yeah, by female pop stars.
Yeah. 30, what, something.
All right, let's find out.
Early 30s.
33.
Okay. I think that somebody in that range can have a comeback. Like Miley, she might come back. You think no?
I think it's dead. I don't think any of these people are going to make it again to the top of the mountain.
I agree because the shape of the mountain has changed. I mean, that is like to me the fundamental thing. It's two things happening at the same time. On the one hand, I don't think that those artists can reach those heights in a new pop economy. The second thing is that the fundamental metrics are different.
Well, that's what You're I was trying to say.
Like
yeah.
maybe Adele, like could Adele have a comeback record?
No, because she has nothing to come back from.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But like Madonna, if she made a Confessions on the Dance Floor, which was an extremely well-received album in 2006, I mean, it probably debuted at number one, but it wasn't like a blockbuster. If she made that album now, it would be considered a huge comeback and not just a return to form because she has no specific
form. But you don't think it would just come and go? Like, you don't think
but
it would just kind of like...
everything comes and goes. The only things that stay on charts are Post Malone. Trust me. We do the chart thing every week.
Billie Eilish. Yeah. And now Roddy Ricch.
Roddy Ricch and BTS.
You know what a real
BTS
comeback
pops
album
out
is?
Fast.
Is that... Karen. Don't talk. Karen. Don't speak about BTS, Careful. Karen.
You know what a real comeback album is?
I can't handle them. Tell me.
Based on a true story. 2 Chainz.
Wow.
2012. To me, that's like, but that's not what people would normally, you
no,
know, you're not thinking in this Madonna framework, sure. but that's somebody who like started a second act of their career higher than ever.
Yes, although I would say comeback does imply that you are returning from a silence or a drought that comes after extreme success, where that didn't happen with Chainz. Like, Chainz just was like sort
you
of
You don't
popping.
Think Duffel Bag Boy was an extreme success?
Play Duffel Bag Boy, not the Lil Wayne verse. You wait. Tell them shout it. So get high. Tell them Weezy. Bop, bop. Or get low. Yeah. It's the beat's so hot. The flow is so ice cold. Walk into the Gucci store. Honey, I'm home. I am on my. I need a pamper on. Toilet paper on the side. For example, homie. Why you wishing on that ball and
matters, in small ways, like how coffee is made, or how a wooden table is built, piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at The New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at The New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to The New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Okay, pivoting to someone we all have a lot of affection for. Here's a question all the way from Scotland, from Martin Young, who says, as someone from Scotland, just to double it up, and roughly the same area as Lewis Capaldi.
I didn't even know he was Scottish. I did not. I believe you.
Joe will set this question out. He's interested in Popcast's take on his rise in America. In the UK, his success was very much built on his social media presence, TikTok, and he's as much of, if not more, a character than a serious musician.
He's like a self-deprecating tweeter.
Right. Does that come across in the same way in the US, and is he taken more seriously over there? Does his humor and self-deprecation translate? Now, let us listen to something that is not humorous and not self-deprecating, which is someone you loved.
I'm going on during this time, I fear there's no one to save me. This all or nothing really got away, you're driving me crazy. I need somebody to hear, somebody to know, somebody to have, somebody to hold. It's easy to say, but it's never the same. I guess I kinda like the way you numbed all the pain. Now the day bleeds into nightfall, and you're not here to get me through it all. I let my guard down, and then you pulled the rug. I was getting kinda used to being someone you loved. I'm going under in this time, I fear there's no one to turn to.
So when I saw Lewis Capaldi interviewed by Ryan Seacrest.
It's the Grammys red carpet.
Yes, Grammys red carpet. Really fascinating. I was watching it originally on mute, and it was so uncomfortable seeing Lewis Capaldi like physically adjusting his body in strange ways while Ryan Seacrest is just ramrod straight and like super professional, and Lewis Capaldi literally looks like he just woke up 20 minutes ago. That really worked for me. But I wouldn't say that Capaldi has been communicating in that way that it's reached me. I assumed he was just like a sappy dude.
I've been told he's very
funny. I've been told that too, but it had not reached me.
Yeah, the answer is no, it has not translated.
The messaging
but it's
is not,
not
there.
It's not that it hasn't.
Lewis like, Capaldi feature on deck.
Right.
We're going to go hang out and make jokes in whatever area of Scotland Martin lives in.
It's not that it hasn't landed. It's that it hasn't happened, right? Like, I don't think that anyone in America knows who Lewis Capaldi is.
Really. They know
they
the,
like
song.
The song.
They yeah, know they know the song. And I don't mean no one. People who show up for 6 a.m. Good Morning America performances know who Lewis Capaldi is. But like outside of that, I don't think.
Rough.
I don't think he's a character here. Sorry.
Karen?
To all my Scots.
I agree.
Sorry. That's it. That's all you have.
That's it.
Okay. So there's your answer. Here's a bit of a, I want to say this is a tough and thought-provoking question. And it comes from friend of the podcast, Laura Snapes. Laura says, there's a real question, and I think I gave it a lot of thought last night. Why have Pine Grove warranted so much press for their new album? I am not entirely sure it sits right.
I don't think the album's that good.
But this is a question about what we choose to cover, why we choose to cover it, how people cover things. So I think there's two parts really implicit to this question. Is one is the merit of the music, and two, is there something that is sinister that is underpinning like the desire to cover this band or to cover their potential redemptive arc?
We should give a little background for people who don't know. Pine Grove is a band from New Jersey. They just put out their
fourth.
I don't count the first one.
Oh, okay. So third, not counting
the first one's
first
like
one.
A collection of
yeah.
cassette.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is all
demos,
you need to know
basically.
About Pine Grove.
yeah. And
they're sort of like they are an emo inclined band, but also a lot of like twinge. Roots, alt country, yeah. folk underpinnings. If you like R-I-Y-L, Bright Eyes.
Yeah, a super sensitive band. And ahead of the release of their previous album, Skylight, yes. the lead singer posted on the band's Facebook that he would be taking some time off, canceling the tour, not putting out the album because he had been accused by a former partner of sexual coercion.
That was his term.
Very light on details. This was a huge kerfuffle in the emo community because this band had picked up a lot of really intense fans.
And sort of like trafficked in vulnerability and a lot of fans perceiving Pine Grove shows and the music of Pine Grove as basically a safe space and a tolerant space.
And so he basically self-canceled for a year, which we found out more recently
was the accuser's request.
Yes, at the request of the accuser that he take some time away from the public stage, mm-hmm. think about his actions, etc., go to therapy. That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They eventually put out that album, that second full length
right.
that was done when the accusation surfaced, and then became a normal band again, and now have released their first album, Marigold, that was written since
yes.
the events.
Right. So I have a couple thoughts on this. One, Karen, I know you are not a huge fan of this record. I like this record. I don't like it as much as I like previous Pine Grove records. I think there is more merit to it. It is a much more, I don't want to say self-pitying, but it is a much more down of a record. It is, you know, the days don't end, the nights, you know, I can't get out of bed. There's a lot of that going on.
To be fair, that's also on the previous
albums. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, sure. I went back to listen to the last two albums, and I think I was struck by the redundancy of some of the themes, the kind of tropes on the new album.
Which I think is on purpose.
But it's weird to have on the one hand him saying, I don't want this to be read autobiographically, and then on the other hand to basically choose to put out songs that seem to allude to having been exiled, in essence. But I think Laura's question maybe is about what do we as journalists deem worthy of covering and why do we give ink? And is the redemption narrative kind of merit the ink on its own? Plenty of people could come back with a redemption album after doing something bad. We don't cover all of them. And is maybe the reason that we covered this, number one, Pine Grove is a band that we're all interested in and have been interested in previously. Number two, not that we're in the business of ranking offenses, but there is a difference between Pine Grove and R. Kelly.
Yes. And even lesser criminal than R. Kelly.
Yes.
He wasn't accused of a crime.
No, of course.
He wasn't accused of
violence, even in the there's so basically there was a two-phase press rollout to Pine Grove. One is the Jen Pelly story in Pitchfork from last year. That was basically the feature she had been working on when Skylight was originally supposed to come out, but then updated with the new information with him kind of before being canceled or self-canceling and then after that. And then Kay Sanna in The New Yorker also spoke to the accuser in a piece that was published a few weeks ago and got more information, some more detail about that. The accuser was someone who had been on tour with the band, who had maybe been part of the crew, it's not entirely clear, and who had a relationship with him and then later came to think that it was the product of a power imbalance.
Which he has agreed with, more or less.
Yeah, in essence, he's agreed with. Although I feel like maybe not 100%. I feel like
we
don't get a lot of like open armed embrace of the I did a bad thing.
There was a strange moment in the New Yorker piece where he said that he didn't realize that as the lead singer of the band that he had power over the crew. And I see this from multiple sides, which is one, when you're in a band like this, a feelings band, a DIY ethos, everyone,
you're in the van together.
Right. You
you're
feel
traveling.
Like you're in this together.
It doesn't
you're
feel like the there's trucks. A hierarchy, but of course there
but
is.
But of course.
Somebody's in
there.
Is.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I have a pretty straightforward answer, which is I think, one, it's runoff because this band has been gaining a lot of critical momentum since the release of Cardinal, you know, in 2016. You know, the first album was this sort of sensation underground, and people didn't usually take that out on a band or an artist the second time around. Like when you see coverage, it's usually a response to the last album. more so than it is the one that's of coming course. Out. And so the Skylight one, you sort of didn't see people unload their critical
because, right,
feelings
because it was
about
just
it,
in,
it was
in,
a false
it was
start.
In flux. It was yeah, yeah. It was on pause.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this was sort of a new time to take a look at what this band has become. And I think that when you add to that the sort of friction of what they went through, it's a very interesting test case about how we let artists
yeah, redemption
back into,
in this era.
Right. Yeah. And mm-hmm. so when you put all those things into play, regardless of what you think of the quality of the music, which I think is high, you know, even if this isn't, you know, maybe you don't like this album, maybe you do. But when you take the narrative tensions plus the musical consistency across the three albums, mm-hmm. it's also like this is the only male-fronted band that matters right now,
right
like
now.
On certain levels.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like there are very few bands doing what Pine Grove is
100%.
Doing and connecting. And I think that it's an interesting test case from various angles. And when you're either a reporter or a critic, it's hard to resist being able to play with all of those possibilities and variables.
But I should say that when we're talking about covering artists like this, like we don't just sort of wake up one day and be like, we're doing Pine Grove and then that's that. Like we all talked about it in advance in terms of whether we'd interview them or maybe I'd review it and which I did end up doing. But this was the subject of multiple conversations over a few weeks, if I remember correctly. And I think we're all extremely attuned to wanting to get the nature of the coverage right. This has come up a lot in previous contexts with XXXTentacion and things like that, where I get a lot of feedback from people who say you cannot cover these people. You
right.
cannot cover people who are
accused
of things
like
this.
We also resist that, period.
Yes, I like fundamentally that is wrong. We are the pop music staff of the New York Times. We are not people who cover only the things we like. We are not people who ignore things we dislike. We are people who cover the news of music. We do it through reporting and we do it through criticism. And if something is having a widespread impact, it is essential that we find a way to weigh in. And sometimes that will be with reporting and sometimes it'll be with criticism, but ignoring something that is popular because of some of the circumstances around it is not the function of a news organization.
We certainly don't only cover things that are morally good or correct. And that's, to me, a bad way to approach journalism and music journalism.
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of things that we've encountered over the course of our careers that have an aspect of immorality, and it could be immoral subject matter or it could be immoral creators. But because it is our job to cover faithfully the scope of popular music as it exists, not as we wish it were, that involves sometimes covering people who other people seem uncoverable.
This is a very nice summary of my job. Thank you, guys.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, I mean, Karen, did you have any reservations about John reviewing this album?
No. I mean, we discussed it. It wasn't like, you know, just an automatic check mark, but I thought the conversations we had were fruitful, and I concur with everything you guys just said.
Yeah. I'm sympathetic to the idea that it is a zero-sum game. Like, if you review the Pine Grove album, you're not reviewing something else.
I believe that less.
I think we could review something
John
else.
John Caramonica's work hours are infinite.
It's true. It's true. It's true. You get to the things you think matter in that way.
That's how I view it. I understand that maybe not other people.
But the tenor of the conversation that I've seen online about Pine Grove getting these, like, the fact that an indie rock band got a New Yorker feature – that's probably happens once a year.
And
maybe
and frankly,
that's
maybe part of what Laura is responding to. And also, you know, we know Kay had my job before he had that job. So we know Kay is very tuned in and has good taste and is interested in this in emo broadly construed as it's been experienced and expressed for 25 years.
Yeah.
It's
naughty. And that's fun for writers.
Yes. Well, I don't know if fun is exactly the right word. But it's
challenging.
It's challenging.
Stimulating in some way.
Speaking of things that are naughty for a writer, Pedro, let me hear Katy Perry roar.
we have a Katy Perry question?
Do we?
Oh, I'm so excited.
I know. I got real pumped when I saw this one. This one comes in from Mark Pitts II. Thank you for the no cap, Mark. I appreciate that. Okay. Mark has a thought about Katy Perry, and I've expressed all my thoughts about Katy Perry.
Speaking of someone who needs a comeback.
Yeah, seriously. But I know Karen would love an opportunity to weigh in on this, so I'm happy that we're going to do this. If we were to do a 10-year challenge from 2020 to 2010, Katy Perry has had a particularly unbecoming career trajectory, especially given how bright her star shined in the early 2010s. It seems that the pinnacle of her superstardom peaked in 2015 after her Super Bowl halftime performance. I actually don't think that that's right. I think it was earlier than that. I think the halftime performance was kind of like already on the decline.
It happened too late.
Yeah. And she has struggled to replicate the same success of One of the Boys in Teenage Dream. Obviously, pop music was more centrist back then, which lent itself to her easily stepping into the role of being everyone's everything, and subsequently trying on different cultures as if she were on a shopping spree at Dover Street Market. But one critically panned album, Witness, shouldn't have the momentum to completely derail the pop star who tied with Michael Jackson for the most number one singles off an album.
Come back.
Would love to hear your honest takes on how Katy Perry got to where she is now, and is there any room for her to make a sizable comeback in this fragmented streaming landscape? Karen the Gans.
How did she get here?
Talk. Speak on it.
An interesting question. I feel like it's very related to the first question just about comebacks.
It is. But
she's a prime example.
And I mean, you interviewed her on her flop.
Yes. I have a knack for that. Yeah. Please, artist, let me come interview you.
While you're in the process of flopping.
Yes.
Karen will embrace you as you are flopping into the latter part of your career.
That was an extremely interesting time for
Katy
Perry.
Good story. Go back and read Karen's Katy Perry interview around The Witness.
Totally
time.
Agree. But okay, so Karen, let's answer this in two parts. Yep. One, what did Katy Perry do wrong? Or was wrong done to her?
It's complicated. I could say something very reductive, which would be, she stopped working with Max Martin.
That's great.
And Dr. Luke.
And Dr. Yeah. Luke.
Speaking of people we have to cover sometimes who maybe have done things that are unbecoming.
I mean, Teenage Dream is actually, I think about it all the time. It's a perfect record.
It's really good.
There's one or two. I believe there's a song called Peacock on that record that I think we could all never hear again. Yeah. But with very few exceptions, it's almost...
It's a great pop album.
Yeah, and, it's almost perfect. I'm like not into Katy Perry really at all. And even I have to kind of give it up for that record. Like ethos is not one that, like, I vibe with at all. But
yeah,
when she was executing at a high level, she was executing at a high level.
There's also, like, that record is kind of, like, nostalgic and has, like, a relentless positivity to it, which is not really typical of our times now.
Okay.
So it does feel out of step. I think, like, she was inching. What year was the following record?
Prism?
Yes.
2013.
Prism was definitely, like, an in-between record. It wasn't good. It wasn't bad. It just kind of was.
And Prism is one where you find her playing with black music a little
more. And this
more.
is where Dark Horse comes in. And I want to talk just for a second about the Dark Horse lawsuit.
I'm preparing to disagree with you because we disagreed in the copy for your story.
Oh, okay. I don't remember what we disagreed about, but okay. Well, I'll say what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
So I don't think Katy has loads of business playing around with these aesthetics. I think she doesn't have any demonstrated skill set in them. She doesn't have a history of collaborating across genre or with hip-hop producers. But I do think that, number one, the lawsuit and her basically getting spanked, to me, felt like a little bit of like a culture spank. Like, you can't do this.
This is
what I
don't
agree
with.
Wasn't it like a Christian rapper? Yes. Like, it wasn't like 2 Chainz was suing her.
Yes, no, fair. All fair. But I think it will prevent the part two is I think getting spanked in that way will be read by her as never to try something like that again. And I think that she doesn't have very many angles left to explore except to go back and do basically a version of what she was doing on Teenage Dream. And I'm not sure that a version of Teenage Dream
plays
in 2020 or 2022 makes any sense.
Yeah, and if you look at her singles from the last 6 months, I know a lot of people like them. This, you know, Zed song, something about riding a motorcycle in Hawaii.
That was a terrible record.
Yeah,
Garbaggio
there's
record.
A couple of those where she's trying to do basically just straightforward white pop.
Yeah.
Again.
The problem is she just hasn't gotten the right song.
But you think if she hit the right song that people would show up for it?
I do.
I don't.
I think if she was the voice on the middle, something, you know, like just any of the like super popular.
Doesn't have the
range. Middle wouldn't be the middle.
She does have the range.
No,
she has a great
doesn't.
Voice. Oh, no. Come on. I have seen her.
You think she has Maren's voice?
No, I'm going into the. I'm a Katy Cat. Is that what they're called? I'm trying.
No, but this is actually a fair question because I was thinking, just in my mind, I was thinking like, what does it really mean for someone to go away and then have something to come back to? And I've always felt that Katy Perry was more a collection of really big songs than a fully realized artist
I think
proposal.
That's true, but you...
And I don't know what she has to come back to. Like, Beyonce can go away for 10 years and come back and still be Beyonce. Katy Perry comes back and she's still the person who did, looking at the list, Part of Me and... E.T. and Firework.
These are huge songs.
I'm not saying they're not big songs. I'm saying that being a collection of big songs is different than being a fully realized artist who has big songs.
All right, I'm going to say something mean.
To who?
Rihanna is an artist who has a collection of big songs.
But she moved into the other phase,
yes,
which Katy Perry was
unable
to do.
And I agree with that. I think the things that made Rihanna that level of artist actually were extra musical. I think they happened outside of music. They were about her role in culture. They were about how she played the celebrity game. Like, she basically turned herself into Greta Garbo on some level, removed herself out of the celebrity narrative, and became three times as big as a result.
Yes.
That was something that didn't have a lot to do with the songs. Now, Anti is like a bit of a scattershot record that has a lot of good songs on it. It's maybe not the most coherent top-to-bottom record.
You're going to get a lot of hate mail for that one.
I have already gotten a lot of hate mail. But... When she sings on that record, she sings really well. And the good songs on that record are really, really, really good. But I agree with what you say, Karen, which is that Rihanna, say, 5 years ago, was in the same fundamental boat that Katy was in.
I've seen them both live in the past 5 years, and you just remark on, like, how many hits does this person have?
Yeah.
But they're all extremely disconnected from each other.
I
and
totally agree.
Mostly in
but
different
genres. But I think what Rihanna did was she made something of herself that's bigger than Rihanna the musician, and Katy has not done that.
Katy has, but just in a very different context. She's like a television personality now. She has a big job on American Idol. She has a giant shoe line.
Nah.
I don't think she's famous in our context.
Katy Perry has a shoe line?
Do you not follow her on Instagram?
I do not follow Katy Perry on Instagram.
There's a lot of shoes.
Actually,
wait,
but
on,
talking
hold
about
on,
this.
Katy Perry shoot.
But you're saying she's not
You know
cool.
what the first autofill is? No, she's not cool. Do you know why? Because the first autofill, Katy Perry shoes, QVC.
Are they chunky?
No, they're not chunky. No, they're like Payless. They're like Katy Payless.
This is not helping your case.
Sorry.
This has nothing to do with her career as a pop star, though.
But it does. It does. A better pop star makes better shoes.
Here's an option.
I don't think so.
Rihanna would not make these shoes.
What
Beyonce
if,
would not. That's at Ivy Park.
I was going to say.
What if Katy Perry made a Maren Morris album? What if she did like a light pop country album? It could work.
I think that would actually work.
She's too lighthearted.
That could be. It could be fun.
I'm sorry. I'm just looking at these shoes.
The pendulum will swing again, and we are going to want something a little more positive.
But she will have aged out. That's the other thing. And something that Taylor really puts her finger on in Miss Americana is basically the pop radio doesn't play women over 35 unless you're Beyonce, and even then you're not really getting played.
I'm sorry.
Still
Katy Perry novelty gingerbread pumps. They are brown pumps. That are look like they are coated in icing with like little red and white sprinkles.
I'm not buying the shoes. I'm just
I know
aware
you're
of
not
existence.
Buying the shoes. I'm not sure if anyone is buying
the shoes. The point you just made about radio is something that Madonna has said a lot, especially during that big Billboard women's speech where she was talking about ageism.
Yeah. And so, so female pop stars are both expected to reinvent multiple times.
Yes. That
in
we,
their
have
careers.
A question. We have a
and
question
to stay
about that.
Under 30.
And to stay under 30 or 35.
Yes.
And I think that basically we already have new Katy Perrys. And like, as crass and cruel as it sounds, like, I don't think that the pop world has much use for her anymore.
Damn, son.
Sorry.
Wow.
That's all right.
But that's what I'm saying. Go to Nashville.
But we
see
have.
See what happens.
Yeah, but then that becomes, okay, not to be all like, let's defend the integrity of country music, but like the universe doesn't need a Katy Perry country album.
I agree, but Katy Perry needs
a
to
Katy
try
Perry
something
country.
Else.
In the same way that I always thought that Eminem should do like a super back to basic kind of like Beats and Rhymes 1986 type record in order to kind of extend. But apparently I was wrong. Right. Well, I mean, all his fans think I'm wrong. Like, his music would indicate that I'm right, but all his fans think I'm wrong. But this is a question. So Kelly Stengel sent a question, and this, it was exactly about this thing that Taylor said about women needing to reinvent and having to remain young. And I wonder, let's talk about the men, for example. She says, why do you think Ed Sheeran, Drake, Post Malone, Shawn Mendes can repeat a similar shtick each album cycle while Taylor, Ariana, Selena, Beyonce have to reinvent themselves?
Drake doesn't fit in that.
Yes, no, obviously. And I actually think that on a micro level, some of these are not right. But I, let's say big picture, Drake does reinvent himself.
More often than
Most women.
Yes.
Yeah, most pop stars or musicians of any kind. Shawn Mendes, sort of low-key, making newish type records.
They're the same.
He's also so young. He hasn't had to truly reinvent yet. But obviously, like, a Timberlake tried it, as we mentioned. And he's going to try it again. And But from the studio photos that we've seen, he's back with the Neptunes. He's back. He's in there with Lizzo. He's in there with Megan or whatever.
There's a photo of him with Lizzo?
Oh, yeah.
I'm so glad that whatever internet you're on, I'm not on. I have not seen the Justin Timberlake and Lizzo photo.
That exists, right, Karen?
Yes, that was real.
Oh, my God.
So he's going to try again.
So wait, so then maybe is the question that this thing that we think is accurate, and Taylor said it and seems kind of right on a surface level, is it actually not true?
It's true.
Maybe it is and maybe it's not.
I don't think pop has much use for men, period.
I agree. And like,
unless you're Post Malone.
Well, this thing, out of everybody on this list, the one that I think that this is the truest of is Post Malone. And I don't think that Post Malone functions in the way that an ordinary pop star functions. The atmospheric quality to his music, the fact that he's not like a very public-facing, like, hyper-pop celebrity.
But did you see his Super Bowl Budweiser commercials?
I think it was Bud Light.
No, it was
Bud Light.
Yeah, remember he did the Bud Light tour?
Doesn't he have the one where he gets a Dorito tattooed on his face?
I didn't see that one.
I think you dreamed that one.
Wait!
Did Post Malone have multiple Super Bowl commercials?
I thought he was great in his Super Bowl commercials,
by the way.
He's
a star.
He's very funny.
I'm not saying that he's not, but he's not a Katy Perry. He's not a Taylor Swift.
Well, there's
he has by design been a little bit more anonymous. He hasn't done loads and loads and loads of press.
They don't let him.
Trust me. Hey, Bo, give me a call if you want to have this conversation. But like, I would love to do a big Post Malone story. He is not functioning in that way. And also, from a pure musical perspective, when you think about how streaming has changed the role and the range of stars that are available to people now, you don't have to be a person who goes out and sells yourself to radio, sells yourself at promotional concerts, constantly selling and selling and selling and selling. You don't have to be that person to be super popular anymore. And Post seems like a good example of someone who kind of bypassed some of that and sort of developed into a strange, idiosyncratic, quasi-cult figure who happens to make songs that never, never end and happen to go to the top of the charts.
I'll be interested to see what Sheeran does next. Like, you know, he did this sort of...
All he does is win.
He did this sort of, you know, out of left field collaborations record, which it doesn't really count as an album and didn't really land.
I think he hopes it didn't count as an album.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm sure it did well. It had a big Bieber single, whatever.
But I want you to know there's a Katy Perry shoe called the Sissy.
You're still at it.
Take his laptop.
But I wonder, do you think Sheeran has to reinvent or can he just do the Adele thing? Adele is a female pop star who does not have to reinvent and will probably be back just as she left us.
Yes.
You know, she had some inciting life events.
Maybe with a Skepta collab.
We'll see, but I will highly doubt that that's going to happen.
Oh, come on. A boy can dream.
It's a remix.
Should we play some Skepta?
No.
Come on.
Next question.
Oh, fine. Here's a two-parter from two different people, both of whom we know. Mitch Goldstein would like to know, number one, does anyone who isn't a music critic slash journalist actually like slash listen to 100 Gex?
The answer
Wait, there's two parts. The second one comes from Foster Gamer, who says, how many Gex does it take to change a light bulb? Should we listen to 100 Gex song?
Yeah. Can we listen to 800 Decibel Cloud?
I'm going to throw my phone into the lake, yeah. It ain't hard to quit, Karen, what you think, yeah. Burn me once and
Okay, now that everybody has had their ears cleansed,
no,
what do people...
No, nobody listens to this except for you guys.
I know at least one person who's not either of those things who listens to it, and we were at a concert where I think kids were really into it. And I get
emails. See the show. Like, these people are not... The people moshing to... The young white men moshing to 100 Gex are not music critics. Trust me.
They will also go mosh to anything.
Not like this.
I also got an email from someone who said that at parties at their college... That Gex, they're playing Gex, Fergie, and Sister Sledge. We're going.
What college
Whoa.
Is this?
We're going.
Whoa.
Sounds like slappers.
Whoa.
What, literally,
Columbia
college.
Just said at Columbia.
Yeah. At Columbia?
Yeah. So we're going.
Invite us.
Yeah. We're going to Columbia. This person actually came with a number of great questions. So I'm going to ask one of these questions. This is something I have thought about a little bit, which is Popcast, it's a little meta, has been notably silent on King Princess and Claro. What is to be made of their relationship to one another as foils or their dueling partnerships with Ronson and Rostam? Do you think they're lastingly important to pop as a genre, lane, or mantle? Basically, can we talk Spotify pollen playlist, which I am not up on, but I assume it's bedroom pop type stuff. So we have not talked about King Princess. Did we review the King? We didn't.
John Perales gave it a critic's pick.
John Perales loved the King Princess album.
Okay.
However, I didn't love it either. And then it's one of those things where it's a critic's pick, but then it doesn't appear in his top 10 list for the year.
That's fine. You can't put every critic's pick on your top 10
list.
But
there's some not. It made me curious.
I want to pull
JP's
back.
JP's not here. You can't drag
You can ask him this on the phone
You can't
after.
Drag his methodology. He's not even sitting here.
Different podcast, Karen.
Oh, my gosh.
The year-end list.
So I was not that high on the King Princess record. I understand the amount of energy and excitement around it.
Was there?
There was, but it dissipated
around
quickly.
King Princess. I don't know about the music, but around King Princess.
Well, see, there's a difference.
I agree.
I actually don't think that these artists have much in common, really, outside of being young, openly queer women.
Who make kind of like pop, like a version of pop. I mean, loosely.
Yeah,
I'm not saying the same version of pop, but I think they both make a version of pop. Like something that we maybe in the 90s would have been very excited about and been like, oh, it's like pop. It's like, you know, it's indie pop. It's pop adjacent. I agree the King Princess proposition is different than the Claro proposition musically.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm probably personally more sympathetic to the Claro proposition, although I
You
not.
Don't love Immunity, which is crazy to me.
No, and I know you like that record a lot, and because of that, I went and gave it like extra tries because I really, really like early Claro music. Like I was really sold, and I was a huge
Unlike
fan.
Unlike Flamin' Hot Cheetos,
and even the songs immediately in the aftermath,
like the EP.
Yeah. And to be honest, Flamin' Hot Cheetos is not even like my favorite in that era. But I didn't respond well to this record. And I know you were really into it. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to go back. I'm going to give it another try. And then I gave it another try. I did two full tries. And it never took for me.
Hmm.
And I don't know if the voice is there. And I also felt like the musical idea didn't feel like her. I didn't feel like she was wearing it super comfortably.
It was a huge change.
Yeah.
I would say it just didn't
feel like it all lined up. Whereas there was something so wholly internally consistent about the early songs. Every part of it seemed like it was in sync with every other part. And I just didn't feel that on this record.
I didn't see this coming for her to make like a little bit of a like shoegazy bedroom indie guitar album.
Mm-hmm.
It just really spoke to me. I think like the way she uses the limitations of her voice is very impressive. I think she has these little knacks for these tiny little hooks that don't feel like hooks.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think lyrically, like, it's just really beautiful. The production is interesting. Rostam did the whole album, which I thought was a cool choice for her to make, considering she could be in there with anyone at that moment when she was, like, this sort of it thing. And she made a sort of small, intimate, just really lovely album to me that I just listened to all the time.
It's interesting because there are certain things about the contour, like she has a super powerful voice, but the contour is really interesting and I think really welcoming. I'm maybe not as old as the lyrics on the lyrics as you are. The parts of Claro that I always found comforting or welcoming were there, but I felt like the clothes that they were in did not feel quite as welcoming.
Karen, what do you think of these two together?
Yeah, we didn't talk about King Princess at all. Though.
I don't think they're in conversation with each other at all, so I would not discuss it from that perspective. I liked but didn't love the Claro record. I love Bags. And I didn't love the King Princess record.
Yeah.
And I went to see her, and it was like a really – there were a lot of ideas on stage and a really cool set built by Sean, who has an amazing eye for these things. But it just didn't feel like it was gelling yet. There were a lot of really excited young queer women, which was an awesome thing to see. I kind of wish that the project had moved along further, like that they were just being delivered something a little bit more evolved in its, you know, in its trajectory.
I think King Princess
took too fast.
Yeah, I think she took a big swing. I think it was King Princess was really supposed to hit on this one. And what I respect so much about the Claro album is that it felt like she avoided that. She really took a step back and went smaller.
It also feels like there's more machine around King Princess. It's a Ronson project. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of important people working on it. She was on SNL immediately.
Yeah.
It felt like it really got like the rocket boost, and I don't know if it was ready from a craft perspective to really get the rocket
boost.
It's
also essentially a major label release. Yes. Claro's is independent. I don't think you can compare Rostam and Ronson at all. Ronson has been, you know, far more places.
Mm-hmm. But perversely, I would venture to say that the Claro-Rostam combination is more polished and maybe even more major label-y than the Ronson King Princess.
I'm interested to see what Claro does next.
Yeah. I think Claro has a lot of upside. There's a lot of upside potential.
Should we play a song?
Oh, absolutely. Which one do you want to hear?
Can we play Softly, Pedro?
I feel like every now and again I'll get an email or a tweet or something that's like, when I read about something relatively small, and it's kind of like, you shouldn't be covering, like, it's not ready to be covered at this level. Now, of course, in 2020, where the internet levels everything, that doesn't mean anything. There's like a, I hate to say this, but there's like a very funny ILM comment about me from like 8 or 9 years ago, where it's basically like, John is messing up the hype cycle. He's like getting to stuff too early, which is hilarious because it's just like, that doesn't exist anymore.
Get that on a mug. John is messing up the hype cycle.
Joe's, I think it was a ruder word than that, but Joe, that could be Joe's next mug for me. But I do think fundamentally the rapid rate at which people accelerate now because of the internet has created a different kind of hype cycle, and sometimes that is problematic. And this question, I thought, was very much in keeping with what we're talking about with King Princess. So this is coming from Michael Harris. And this is the question. I would appreciate if you could talk about whether Mitski got pushed too far to the top in 2018. What?
I know. These are back-to-back challenging questions.
That's
about
fine. That's
indie
why,
rock hype cycle.
Yeah, but that's why we're here.
What was Mitski pushed to the top of? She was pushed to the top of a certain type of Twitter thing.
She opened for Lorde.
Yeah, we saw that.
Yeah, that was, you know.
That doesn't count.
She had a grander headlining show with choreography and a much different looking kind of show.
Totally agree.
Felt more like inching into a pop sphere.
I mean, I wonder if what's underpinning this question is, I interviewed Mitski on the previous album cycle, and like part of the Mitski energy at that time was being maybe uncertain or ambivalent about being so public-facing and how to present and how to give interviews and whether
– it was a fragile moment.
Right, and whether giving interviews is even like a valid thing to do. So I wonder if part of the unspoken premise of this question is for a person who was coming from that perspective who then suddenly got a lot of rapid acclaim from people like us and elsewhere in the world – did the next step, you know, instead of going from a 3 to a 5, they went from a 3 to an 8. And is that too much too fast for an artist for whom fragility was like baked into the thing? Maybe. That's not all written there. That's just me freestyle.
She's like a year-end list.
Honest.
Wow.
Savage.
Like,
so wrong.
I don't think
so
she,
rude.
Like, I don't think she.
Joe, that's rude.
I stand by it.
That's
I don't
rude.
Think she.
I think Joe said what he said.
He did say what he said.
I don't think she capital M matters in the way that people who still read Pitchfork think she does.
I will agree with that.
Like, these sound like shots.
It's still a good record, but yeah.
Yeah, but, and the other thing I'll say is going back
also
to the Pine Grove.
The most recent record is not as good as the previous
That's what
record.
I was going to say.
Yeah, it's not
going
as good.
Back to the Pine Grove thing, I think Mitski is another great example of everything sort of catching up at this moment. I think what we saw happen with Mitski is there was a lot of pent-up praise from the previous two albums that hit with Be the Cowboy. And I think you got
to
this.
To be fair, some of us got to her while.
Look. You effed up the
John,
hype cycle.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah.
I think that, you know, having a New York Times feature on Puberty 2 for the people who pay attention to these sorts of things, like, puts her on a different level. And I think
and
basically
also there was
all
that
culminated.
Strange, yes, and then there was that strange kind of off-cycle New Yorker story
yeah.
in between Puberty 2, and maybe that was meant to be part of the rollout of Be the Cowboy, but, like,
yeah,
I think it was, like,
it was too early,
for yeah. that. Yeah, I
think
agree.
It culminated at a moment when maybe it wasn't her top moment,
which is
a weird combination of feelings and incentives.
Here is something else about Mitski, is that for all of Mitski's ambivalence during the Puberty 2 era, there was one thing that I was very struck by when I spoke with her, and I think came out in other articles, other interviews she gave, which I do think she had a tremendous amount of self-confidence and a tremendous amount of ambition. And I think this is something that I have, I don't think struggled with, but it's something that I have had to realign myself, my thinking about in the last few years. Because, and this came up in your Soccer Mommy story, when someone makes a lo-fi record, I have historically treated it as you made a choice to make a lo-fi record, and not that everybody has all the resources in the world and chooses that, but that you accept that you have this set, this pool of resources, and then you choose to make a record that works within those resources rather than pushes against them. But increasingly, what you're seeing, especially as people are getting famous much earlier, is they're saying, well, I only made that because I had no other choice but to make
and
that.
And I'd be happy to have a top 40 record.
Yes, and that, I think, I don't think that's exactly – I mean, that is exactly what Sophie Soccer Mommy said, but I don't think it's exactly what Mitski said. But I do think what you see on Be the Cowboy is some of that ambition, some of that bigger confidence of being like, I can do all these things. I'm going to do more instead of this narrow framework that Make Out Creek and ultimately Puberty 2 were working within.
It's also screwed up. Because now you can get super popular with the thing that sounds like you can't. Like something
right.
like even going back to Clara, like
yes.
Pretty Girl has
yes.
bazillion views on YouTube. And that ultimately is new. Like you would have thought that that would have hit a ceiling because of how it sounds. And yet with these new channels for distribution,
right.
you can have a hit that doesn't sound like
so
it's
basically
supposed to be
you
a
can
hit.
Have a hit that doesn't sound like a hit, but you are also would make a different kind of song if you could make a different kind of song. And so I sometimes have to, I find myself when I'm interviewing people almost walking in with the wrong presumption. And obviously as a journalist, you try not to walk in with any presumptions, but as a critic, you get excited about a piece of art that makes a lot of sense. And so the natural instinct is to be like, everything behind that piece of art was intentional.
It just reminds me so much of what happened with Liz Phair, where mm-hmm. she got famous off these lo-fi records, and she just decided basically to make an Avril Lavigne record, and
yes.
everybody turned on her.
Yes.
And now there's been a reevaluation of that album.
Yes,
yes.
Of course.
People like it. So I guess the takeaway question here
also,
for you.
Also, shouts to Avril Lavigne.
Yeah.
And that album, that Liz Phair album, has always been amazing.
Is Mitski going to pull back, or is she going to go bigger?
I say go bigger.
I say pull back.
Mm. And that, I think that'll be the answer.
Based on, I don't know, just like reading the leaves.
All right, let's mark this.
We'll
in the...
put a Popeyes bet on it.
Yeah. We'll come back to this.
Let's listen to a great Mitski song that is not on the most recent record. Let's listen to I Bet on Losing Dogs.
I know they're
Okay, so we are going to stop chugging along right now. We're going to take a break, come back with part two of Listener Mailbag very soon. Thank you to Joe and to Karen for sitting here and being game. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us more and more questions. You are making us think hard. We appreciate it. Podcastnytimes.com and subscribe to Podcast anywhere you get your audio content. Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, etc., etc. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week.